This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the High Yield Cash Account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A High Yield Cash Account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Turns out monopolizing trade is a felony. Who knew? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 20th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We turn today to Title 15 of the United States Code, Section 2, which reads, in relevant part, every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among the several states shall be deemed guilty of a felony, and on conviction thereof shall be punished by fine not exceeding $100 million if a corporation. So if you don't know, now you know. The corporation in question, of course, is Google, which found itself on the receiving end of an antitrust lawsuit today filed by the Department of Justice and 11 state attorneys general. So as we do when technology leads the news, we've gotten Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the phone to make us smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So I get so many questions. Number one is Google's been around for a long time. It's been ginormous for a very long time, dominant for a very long time. What took so long for this to happen?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because, and in fact, the, you know, Department of Justice notes this in their filing, there is legally a difference between being really, really, really big and really dominant, as you know, and between maintaining that dominance in a way that crosses over into illegality. And so it takes a while to make that case, basically, that maintaining the dominance is the illegal part, whereas it's fine to just be gigantic.
Right. What's the counter argument? What's Google going to say? We're just doing our business, man. Nobody here but us chickens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yes, Google's counter argument is that this is a flawed lawsuit and that there are plenty of options out there for search. Their official blog post rebutting the filing of this lawsuit included a lot of GIFs in which people use Bing, Microsoft Bing. So if you know anybody who does, definitely let me know. I want to talk to them. And then the counter argument to, you know, kind of the lawsuit itself, which a lot of pundits said, and even legal scholars, people who worked on, for example, the Microsoft case in the 90s, said, you know, this case could have been bigger. There were suggestions that it was being rushed, even over the objection of some career lawyers and state attorneys general, in order to get it out before the election. And the scope of it is very limited to search. The counterargument to all of that, of course, is you got to start somewhere, and these cases are a big deal.
Right, and search is kind of the low-hanging fruit. Let me just back you up a minute to that Bing thing. You are, and we've talked about this on Make Me Smart, our podcast, you're a devoted user of DuckDuckGo. For its privacy implications, of course, it's more protective than Google is. But also, the point being, how many really good options are there if you want comprehensive search? It's got to be Google, right? Because they've got all the data and everything?
Well, There are a couple arguments around that. One is that people perceive Google to have better search results because it's a filter bubble, because Google knows a lot about you. So it'll say, oh, if you, the example actually that a lawyer I talked to today gave was that maybe there's a plumber in your area and a lot of people have used that plumber before. And so they'll search, they'll service, give you that search option first. But in fact, you might not want that. You might want somebody who's better vetted or something along those lines. The core of the argument that the Department of Justice is making here is that Google has paid a ton of money to device makers, including Apple, and using its own Android platform to make sure that Google is the default. So that every time I, for example, want to use DuckDuckGo in a browser or on my Apple device, I have to find the setting that lets me change that default. And most people don't.
Right. And that default thing was what got Microsoft in trouble, right? With back low these many years ago, the last time we had an antitrust thing was they were putting
this.
Right.
Yeah. This lawsuit, in fact, is very, very similar to the Microsoft case. Someone on Twitter referred to it as almost a cut paste.
Well, you know, they can they can do that at the Justice Department. We got a half a minute tops. What now happens inside Google as they fight this thing? Because I imagine even though they can afford a lot of lawyers, it's going to suck a little bit of the life out of them.
It's a big deal. It's a really big deal. Even if you quibble about the scope and whether they should have included advertising and data, the fact is that these cases have major impacts. It set Microsoft back a decade of innovation. It set IBM back a decade, back in starting in 1969, AT&T. So Google spends a lot of money, a lot of time, and is very, very distracted trying to fight this thing.
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
Alphabet shares today, by the way, Google's parent company, up a bit less than 1.5%, which I looked up on Google Finance. Irony intended. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Housing and spending related to housing accounts for about 15% of this economy. So says the National Association of Home Builders, which makes it no small thing that the housing market continues to overperform if you're on the building or selling side of that equation. The Commerce Department said this morning housing starts were up 11% from a year ago. That's literally groundbreaking on new homes. There will be a revision, of course, as the data gets smooth, but the overall trend is definitely up. Really, it's about low interest rates, which are making borrowing cheaper than it's ever been for would-be home buyers in this economy. If, that is, you can get those record low rates. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
I'm about to do something I'm pretty sure I will immediately regret. Request a quote to refinance my mortgage. I go to one of those online aggregators, type in my address, the size and type of the loan I'm looking for, 30-year fixed, and my cell number, and boom. Calls, text messages, and emails start rolling in, offering rates from 2.5% with $3,500 in fees to 3.62% with zero fees. According to Freddie Mac, the average interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is a record low 2.81%, with a fee of about 0.5% of the total loan. But Deputy Chief Economist Len Kiefer says there are reasons the same individual can get wildly different offers.
Particularly this year, with a lot of volatility in financial markets, a lot of different lenders are facing different economic circumstances. We've seen the variation in rates in our survey actually widen quite a lot.
Some of those circumstances? Tendai Kapfidze is chief economist at LendingTree. He says lenders have different borrowing costs. Sometimes they're just trying to make their numbers, or
if a lender has a big office in an expensive neighborhood, they're going to have to cover that cost with the profits from the mortgages.
But lenders aren't going to let you in on all that. They may still offer you a low rate, but tack on a lot of fees. Bankrate chief financial analyst Greg McBride says this is one of those times where it really does pay to shop around.
That time invested to get a lower rate on your mortgage generates a great return on investment when you're able to shave, you know, a quarter or half a percentage point off of the loan rate you otherwise would have gotten.
And getting the best rate may mean you actually have to pick up the phone. Hello, this is Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Very nicely done, Ms. Scott. Very nicely done. Tomorrow morning, the Marketplace Morning Report. David Boncaccio and the gang. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. We are going to dip back into our Marketplace Edison Research poll here for a little bit. Lots of great data points about this economy in it and how people are feeling about this economy. Today, how they're feeling about their jobs, and the short answer is not great. More than half of Americans are afraid of losing their jobs over the next 12 months. And needless to say, living in fear of unemployment, especially during a pandemic when there are countless other things to stress you out, can take an additional huge psychological and emotional toll. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on that one.
Hervé Monpoint has this routine that helps him get to sleep. He drinks chamomile tea, then lies down in bed and pulls up the most boring video he can find on YouTube.
You know, like when you put on the History Channel late at night back in the 90s, early 2000s or something.
But the other night, even that didn't do it. At 3 a.m., he was wide awake, pacing the room, thinking about work.
I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. For a good while, it felt like if I sat down and took a breath, I was just going to explode.
Monpoint works at an engineering firm in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ever since he started working from home during the pandemic, his productivity has fallen. He gets distracted easily by his dog and household chores. Also, the software his company uses hasn't been working right.
And that's taken an even harsher toll on my production rates. And I keep getting emails about my production numbers being low, and it's kind of put me in a state of panic.
Monpoint thinks he might lose his job, and he's not confident that he'd find another one in this economy. A lot of people are living in a state of constant fear right now about getting sick and about losing their livelihoods, their jobs, maybe their homes. Rodrigo Amayel works in sales for a company in Massachusetts that programs pharmaceutical and biotech conferences.
There's just an incredible amount of uncertainty right now as to when we're going to be able to go back to having actual revenue from live events, which is probably 90% of the revenue for the company.
He's gotten through a few rounds of layoffs, but he worries he'll be next, which is making it hard to function, especially because he's a single dad.
For the past couple of weeks, I've been completely paralyzed. I really don't know where to put my efforts and how to make myself valuable to the company.
He finds himself meditating and exercising a lot to cope.
I used to do these things for well-being, and now it feels like I'm doing these things just to keep my head above water.
For some people, this moment of financial uncertainty also brings grief. Cecilia Feely runs the Rutgers University Transportation Autism Project, which looks for ways to make public transit more accessible for people with autism. Because of the pandemic, the funding has run dry. Her hours were just cut, and she fears the program will disappear entirely.
I just feel like, you know, a lot of sadness and almost like a loss of something. So, and because I helped create it, it wasn't really like just a job. It was like kind of like, you know, my baby or something that I feel like is slipping away.
Feely is a transportation engineer and started the program 10 years ago when her son, who's now 21, was diagnosed with autism.
And I know that there's still a lot of need for the population.
There's not one easy answer for how to get through this kind of fear and grief. Therapists say some things can help. Meditation, long walks, whatever brings you at least momentary peace or joy. And maybe it helps to remember that what you're feeling is not surprising, given the circumstances. And there are a lot of other people up at 3 a.m. right now. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up,
our grapes essentially quit making sugar.
Well, that's not good. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up about 113 points today. Exactly 113 points, 0.4%, 28,308. The NASDAQ found 37 points in the couch cushions, 0.3%, 11,516. The S&P 500 added 16 points, 0.4%, 34.43. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said this week that more Americans than ever obtained a basic bank account in 2019. The FDIC estimates that about 5.5% of Americans are still considered unbanked last year. That is the lowest percentage since it started keeping track in 2009. Here's the bad thing, though. Data was collected before the pandemic and the recession hit. Amy was talking about the housing market. Here are some builders. Lennar and D.R. Horton both rose 0.9%. PulteGroup packed on 1.2%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 0.79%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Trump administration is clear about what it wants to happen with immigration. Less of it. Illegal, legal, seasonal, skilled workers, just less. Two new proposed rules would limit the number of foreign workers allowed in under what are known as H-1B visas, visas typically reserved for skilled workers, and the rules would force American companies to pay those workers more. A group of U.S. businesses and trade groups and universities has filed suit to stop those rules from going into effect, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
One of the new rules from the Labor Department would require U.S. companies to pay foreign workers on H-1B visas 35 to 200% more. Linda Kelly is general counsel for the National Association of Manufacturers, one of the trade groups behind the lawsuit.
The cost to employers will be $198 billion over 10 years.
Another rule limits the jobs that H-1B workers can fill. Kelly says all kinds of businesses would be affected, those employing researchers, chemists, doctors, like ARUP Laboratories in Salt Lake City, which, among other things, does coronavirus testing. It now has about 100 H-1B medical lab scientists. Misty Smith heads talent acquisition there. She says U.S. schools just aren't producing enough scientists.
I could literally hire everybody in the United States, graduates each year, and it probably still would not meet our needs.
Some U.S. companies have turned to outsourcing firms. They sponsor workers on H-1B visas, then subcontract them to U.S. firms. The Labor Department wouldn't do an interview, but did send me a statement saying the rule is intended to stop abuses. Britta Glennon teaches at the Wharton School. She says there are abuses. Some of those subcontractors pay substantially less than what American workers make.
Many of the Indian outsourcing companies are paying $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 as opposed to $100,000+.
But Glennon says U.S. companies only turn to the subcontractors because there's a cap on how many H-1B visas employers can get. She says ultimately, U.S. companies just open foreign affiliates and hire as many guest workers as they want. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As we head into the third wave of this virus, a lot of offices and workplaces are still trying to figure out how to handle it. Should people stay home? If so, when could they come back? Should companies administer tests for their workers, and who gets to know the results of those tests? There are no real strong national rules for a lot of this stuff, so states have been left to fill in the gaps. A law goes into effect in January out here in California that is going to set up requirements for companies when somebody does get COVID. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
There's been no work from home or shelter in place for tens of thousands of warehouse workers in Southern California, says Shaharyar Kaushi with the Warehouse Workers Resource Center.
We call them essential workers. We talk about how important they are.
Yet he says often they haven't gotten essential information about COVID cases on the job.
There was a lot of fear. A lot of the time the employer would say, well, I can't tell you that, or we're not going to talk about that.
But starting at the beginning of next year, California employers will have to notify all workers of any potential COVID-19 exposure in the workplace within one day of learning of the risk, and inform public health authorities of an outbreak of three or more infections within 2 weeks. Nationally, employers have no such obligation, says Debbie Berkowitz with the National Employment Law Project.
Without that information, I don't really know how workers can protect themselves.
She says the lack of federal reporting requirements also sometimes leaves resource-thin public health departments to discover workplace clusters only through lengthy investigations.
In the absence of any requirement, it is almost impossible for the local public health agencies to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
But informing an entire workforce of potential COVID risk can be complex for organizations, says Sean Kramer, an employment law attorney in San Francisco. He cited a truck driver who visits multiple sites and has many limited interactions.
There's the potential for over-notification to employees as a sort of a stopgap or a fail-safe, and it may ultimately scare employees.
And while the law prevents employers from naming names, in many workplaces, the identity of an infected person would be hard to hide. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
If anything good comes out of 2020, it might just be that more people finally started taking climate change more seriously. I mean, yes, it's been happening for decades, but calamity does tend to focus the mind. Sea level rise and more intense hurricanes on the Gulf Coast and the Eastern Seaboard. More and bigger wildfires out here in the West, burning bigger and hotter. And extreme weather in the Midwest and the South has been getting more extreme. All of that is planetarily existential, of course, but more immediately, it's going to have some big implications for American agriculture. As Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, for American farmers, climate change isn't just coming, it's here.
It is harvest season, and Don Cameron is out in his field in Fresno, California. His mechanical tomato harvester is moving its way along, picking up to 50 tons of tomatoes per hour.
The tomatoes, though, have had a tougher time during the summer when we have continuous days of temperatures over 110 degrees. And the blossoms tend to fall off, but just one of the many crops that we grow here that's being affected by changes in our climate.
Cameron's almonds and pistachios bloomed erratically this year because the winter was too warm. His peppers got sunburnt, and then came the wildfires.
The smoke we had for over 30 days cut down on the sunlight we had, and our grapes essentially quit making sugar.
Climate change has arrived in American agriculture. Researchers have modeled the impacts of climate change on barley, rice, wheat, soy, cotton, and corn over the next 30 to 50 years.
Without any changes in what farmers are currently planting, the total profits across the six major crops that we looked at in the United States would drop by about 30%.
James Rising is a research fellow at LSE's Grantham Research Institute. His work was published in Nature Communications.
All across the U.S., most counties by 50 years from now are going to have to be planting something different from what they're currently planting.
But switching is expensive. A lot of crops need specialized harvesting and planting machines, processing equipment, supply networks, not to mention decades of accumulated farmer expertise.
It's very hard to make substantial changes to your farm and your cropping system when you're just hanging on year to year.
Ben Aliston is with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. He says some farmers will need financial help to make changes.
Agriculture policy is way behind. Our farm bill was just passed in 2018 and had no mention of climate change at all within it.
And yet, farmers are already adapting, and you can see it on the map.
You have, over the last several decades, seen the Corn Belt shift north. So there are parts of Minnesota, for example, where corn is grown, where it was more traditionally wheat.
Still, straight-up switching crops is not very common. More often, farmers and suppliers are adapting in less drastic ways. Fred Yoder grows corn, soybeans, and wheat in western Ohio.
When I was growing up farming with my father back in the 60s and 70s, we planted our crops anywhere from the 1st of May to the end of June. And today, we're planting a lot of our crops by mid-April, and we're trying to beat that heat in the summertime.
In addition to planting earlier, Yoder says farmers in his area are planting cover crops to help retain moisture between wild swings of flooding and drought. And he puts a lot of faith in the development of plants that can survive changing conditions.
As genetics have gotten better, the varieties we use today are nothing like the varieties we used 30 years ago.
Of course, the changes in climate are different in different parts of the country. Jennifer Holofsky directs the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Northwest Climate Hub. It's part of a network that provides advice to farmers.
In the Pacific Northwest, we're expecting much warmer summers
and then not a lot of precipitation to make up for that. So a big focus is dry farming techniques to grow crops that don't need as much irrigation.
Still, some farmers have been reluctant to characterize challenges with weather as being related to climate change. Again, Ben Alliston with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy.
Climate change is a very politically almost toxic term in a lot of parts of rural America because it's become a partisan issue. And I think I see that shifting over the last several years.
Extreme events, flooding, drought, the August derecho are galvanizing some farmers to look ahead. According to models, in 50 years, 7% of cropland for the U.S.'s main commodity crops won't be profitable at all. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the trials and tribulations of J.C. Penney continue. The company said this morning it expects to get out from under Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection by the holidays. Should save about 70,000 jobs, 650 stores. Now, consumers and what they are going to do during the holidays, that's a whole nother thing. Arguably the big thing, given how important a holiday is to retail in this economy. All right, we are going, but not before I give you your Tuesday moment of economic context out of Amy's piece on mortgage interest rates a couple of minutes ago. You don't have a mortgage, most likely you rent, and it is getting tougher out there. The National Multifamily Housing Council's Rent Payment Tracker shows just shy of 87% of apartment households in this economy had made a full or partial rent payment as of October the 13th. That is down almost 2.5 percentage points from a year earlier on a national basis. That is, fewer people are able to pay. Said the president of the council there is, quote, growing localized financial distress due to inaction by political leaders in Washington. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.